So tonight's topic is the Metta Sutta, the Buddha's teaching on loving kindness. Traditionally, when things like this were taught, and still in certain corners of Southeast Asia, the teacher wouldn't actually teach you the meaning of this, something like this, the sutta, until you could chant it perfectly. And once you could chant it perfectly, then you could learn what it actually meant. Well, I'm not going to ask you all to learn this and chant it perfectly, but I think it's very appropriate that the first thing I do is chant the sutta, just so you can get a sense for the beauty of the language, which comes across so well when it's chanted. So I would ask you, I mean, if you have a copy of the sutta there in front of you, you can chant along with me, or you can just follow along with me, or you can just close your eyes and take in this the beauty of this language. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child. So with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness. One should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. So that's the Metta Sutta. And it so clearly states the idea of how we have to have thoughts of loving kindness towards all beings. That's what the the core of this whole teaching is that, it's easy to have loving kindness for individuals, people we're close to, our partners, our children, our parents, some of our coworkers, our buds. But to be able to extend that thought of loving kindness out into the entire world, that's what the Buddha was talking about. And it's just so important. And this isn't like some idea that's unique to the Buddha. In the Christian tradition in Corinthians, there's a line I love that says, "And now abideth faith, hope, and love. These three, but the greatest of these is love." And then there's Jesus the night before he knows he's going to be crucified, meeting with his disciples. And what does he say to them? He says, "And this I command you, love one another." So this is like a theme, and you'll find this in the Jewish tradition and in other traditions that it's a universal idea. But the Metta Sutta is a certain form of this idea. And I think it's interesting to know the story behind it. I mean, why did the Buddha teach the Metta Sutta? What's the traditional teaching on this? And there's a longer teaching of which the Metta Sutta is sort of embedded. And the story goes like this: the Buddha is with a bunch of bhikkhus, and they were wanderers, and they would go out into the forest, right? So it'd be quiet, and they could practice. And so, they're finishing their morning alms rounds, and now the Buddha's going, "Okay, go out into the forest. Go out, find, sit at the root of a tree, and practice." And at the end of the day, they come back and they're all really upset and frightened. And the Buddha's going like, "What's going on, guys?" And they say, "Oh, this forest is horrible. It's so scary. It's full of evil tree spirits. And they don't want us here. And they're just like disturbing us all day when we're trying to practice. These evil tree spirits were bothering us. And they were really afraid." And what the Buddha taught that evening was the Metta Sutta. The Metta Sutta was originally meant as an antidote to fear. And when you think about fear, it's like, "Oh, I'm never afraid," you probably might think. But actually, fear is the root underneath a lot of other powerful emotions like anger, like loneliness. These are based on fear, but it's like masked underneath this top layer. We all have times when we're afraid of either afraid of something external or afraid of what's going on in our own lives or not going on in our own lives. So I think metta is a very powerful, skillful means in terms of how we can practice. The second but last part of the story, of course, is the monks went out the next day to sit, and they had thoughts of loving kindness to the tree spirits, and the tree spirits were like totally cool. In fact, now the tree spirits were very busily trying to keep the other local people away from the monks so they could meditate peacefully. So they sort of connected to them. That's or so the story goes. But what does this whole sutta mean? And so the rest of this talk, I really want to talk about what's in this sutta. And sort of not quite line by line, but I'm going to go through a lot of the sutta and point out what it's saying. And starts off, "This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace." So right off, the Buddha is saying, this is something that should be done. Loving kindness isn't something that we sort of, "Well, I'm a good person and I'm nice to people, I'm okay." This is something It's like us, it's something we actually have to consciously practice. It has to be done. We can't sort of just blow it off. It's a something we have to pay attention to. And not only that, he says this should be someone who is skilled in goodness. So we have to actually learn. We have to learn something to be skilled in it, to be skilled in goodness. So it isn't just, oh, I'm a good person. It's like, I'm skilled in goodness. It's another layer on top of our everyday nice people vibe, right? And this is like, and he knows the path of peace. Path of peace, I mean, what the Buddhist course referring to here is the Noble Eightfold Path. So someone who understands the Buddhist teachings and practices them, and who knows, so know, remember know in Buddhist talk always means knows that some deeper, not so much intellectual as intuitional heart level. So this seems like, this is like, wow, this is a big ask, right? I have to be skilled in goodness, and I have to know the Buddhist teachings. And what we have to understand is that this teaching, like many of the Buddhist teachings, is progressive. That's where we're headed. We want to head towards, we want to become more knowledgeable. We want to have a deeper understanding of the Buddhist teachings. We want to become more skilled in goodness. But it just takes time. It isn't like, okay, I'm going to do this and everything will be, next week I'll have it. This is like a lifetime of practice here. And then the next part of the sutta, he goes on basically to describe in more detail what it would be like to know the path of peace. So, straightforward and gentle in speech. Well, this is one of the Buddha's favorite themes, right? All over the place, he's talking about right speech, wholesome speech. So straightforward is like not only ever telling the truth, but also being like open, straightforward, not hiding things. And gentle, soft, not, someone, no pounding the desk as you speak and trying to, force your way through with your loud voice. It's something that's people won't find threatening. So it's a non-threatening way of speech. And then the next line says, humble and not conceited. Humble also refers to speech. It's like not boasting or stretching the truth to look good. But not conceited is the idea that we should think of others as the same as us. That we shouldn't get caught in judging and comparing. Like, some people are good and some people are bad. Some people deserve to have thoughts of loving kindness towards them. Other people don't. I'm better than other people. Anyway, oh, I'm one of those holy people who has loving kindness for everyone. So I'm better than everyone else. This is where it's really dangerous. All spiritual practices have this inherent danger that we get caught in that way of thinking. That somehow I'm up here and they're down there, those unwashed, non-metta masses, it's just, we have to be careful of that. And it's very difficult to have feelings of metta for others if you look at them in that way. If you don't see them as the same as you, just a human being struggling in the world, it's very difficult to have thoughts of loving kindness towards them. And he goes on, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways. So contented and easily satisfied, it's like, oh, I'm okay. I have enough stuff. I don't need to sort of accumulate more. I don't have to buy into the cultural belief that The people with the most stuff wins. Right? It's okay to just have what I have and be content with what I have. And then he says, contented and easily satisfied. So it's like, oh, I don't need a lot of stuff. Unburdened with duties. This is tricky. This is tricky because we all have duties. We're householders, right? We're not monastics, and even monastics have duties. But as householders, we have a lot of duties to our partners and our family, and as citizens, as members of a sangha. There's duties involved in all of these things. So we shouldn't feel like they're a burden. They're just what we do to be a good citizen in the world, a citizen of the world, and not also at the same time to be unburdened with duties. It's saying, don't take on too much. Often our culture really glorifies being busy. It's like someone says, oh, that person's really busy, but I want to sort of get some time with them. It's like they must be really important because they're so busy, right? Well, often people are so busy because they just can't sit still. And they take on too much. And so this is like unburdened with duties. It's like not getting caught in that idea that I got to keep on doing more and more and more. We have duties, we should perform them. And also, yes, and we have, and frugal in their ways. So live simply. You don't need to lead an elaborate life. Try and live a life of simplicity as much as possible. That you don't need a lot. This also points to the idea that if you're frugal in your ways, then you need less money, stuff coming in to function, gives you more time to practice. It's a simple, it's pretty much a straight line equation. If we're busy working 60 hours a week to make more money and be able to pay off the mortgage and whatever it is, and not that there's anything wrong with paying off the mortgage, then we get caught up in being exhausted and not having time to practice. And it's like it's a balance we're trying to find in life. Then peaceful and calm. And so this is just a mind state that's being described that we wish to have at the start when we practice metta. We want to practice metta from a place of peace and calm. But it can't be phony. It can't be like, oh yeah, I'm peace and calm. I'm just call me Mr. Mellow, Joseph Goldstein tells this great story about this particular aspect of things. He was doing a 3-month retreat, and he was every day as part of his practice, he'd go for this long walk through the neighborhood around Insight Meditation Society, and there was this one yard he'd go by, and there's this really sort of fierce, big, barky dog that would always, he'd walk by and the dog would come rushing out and it would really disturb him, and he'd be sort of afraid of it, right? Okay, so, oh wait, Metta Sutta is about dealing with fear, right? So he decides what he's going to do is when he gets to near to where the dog is, he's going to be very peaceful and very calm, and he's going to offer metta to the dog. He's going to actually just say that, offer the traditional metta phrases to the dog, even though the dog is barking and all that sort of stuff. So he's just walking along and he's at this place and he's like, I'm going to be really calm now. I'm going to be really calm now. And the dog comes rushing out and just barking and snarling. And he offers the dog the metta phrases and the dog bites him on the hand because he didn't really have that peace. If you've been around dogs and Dogs know you're afraid. Dogs are really smart and perceptive in that way. And if you're really afraid, they know, and then they react to that fear. So, and then once Joseph got past that and realized what was going on, then he said, okay. He just started taking a slightly different route on his walk, and he avoided the dog completely. And that was a very wise thing to do, given what he was trying to accomplish. Then at the end of this long list of things, he says, not proud and demanding in nature. So not be one a person who keeps demanding other people or wanting has to be a certain way. Oh, I can't practice metta unless it's really quiet, so all you people have to be really quiet. Or whatever. That I so you have to do things in a certain way so I can do what I need to do. No demands. Not demanding in nature. But then there's this the final line is let him not do let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. So the Buddha's given this big long list of all these, wholesome attributes, essentially. And then he wants to make sure that everybody understands that this isn't a complete list. And so it's like, oh, and by the way, anything else that the wise, which are the enlightened ones that the Buddha traveled with, if they won't reprove anything else you might do. Don't, so it's like, just in case you thought this was like anything, you could sort of weasel your way out of things. No, I'm sorry. Everything else you have to consider that too. And this is actually a classic Buddhist dialogue trick. You'll see a lot of lists that at the end there'll be a list, a phrase, something like this. Oh, well, yes, that's all right, but don't forget other thing, anything else you can think of that would be unwholesome. Don't do that either. So that's that first section, which I think of that first section is sort of like the introduction to the sutta, saying, here's the qualities of heart mind that you want to work towards having more of, because that will enhance your practice of metta. It isn't saying you have to be perfect before you start, which is where I've heard people say, oh, look, it's got to be all these things before you can even practice metta. No. It's like this is the start of something, and these are qualities you want to remember and try and cultivate in your heart mind as you are practicing metta. And it's sort of a feedback loop in some ways too. But then he goes on, says, now he's actually giving instruction. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. This is the basic instruction on what we want to do with our mind when we're practicing metta. We want to wish people to live in a world of gladness and safety. And may they be at ease. So when metta is practiced formally, at least in the way I've learned it in the tradition I come from, we repeat these four phrases. May you be safe, may you be happy, may you be healthy, may you live with ease. So it's a little expansion over what it says in the sutta, but I think healthy is there because how can you live at ease if you're not healthy? So it's like just adding that in a sense. But the idea behind metta, when you think about these phrases and what they mean, is really what we're saying when we say these phrases is it would be nice to have ideal conditions to practice. Think about what it would be like if you always felt safe, happy, healthy, and at ease. At ease means without anything pressing on you, that stuff in the world isn't pressing on you in any way. You have enough to eat, and you have appropriate place to live, and all the basics of life are all taken care of. So you're not just pushed to the edge all the time. This is what we're actually wishing for others. This is what the idea behind metta is, that people have this as the basis of their life, that they feel safe, happy, healthy, and to live with ease. The interesting thing is, and I want to actually read a little bit. This is Kevin Griffin's book, Living Kindness. And here's the interesting thing about metta when it's taught, and that's that. Actually, I had the phrases I had, may you be safe, may you be happy. But actually, traditionally, when we practice metta, the first thing we always do is wish metta for ourselves. May I be safe, may I be happy, may I be healthy, may I live with ease. I have to feel that first. I have to take care of myself first. And this, it sounds sort of selfish, but it's not. And Kevin talks about this quite wisely, so I thought I'd just read what he has to say here. So the challenge of practicing loving, or indeed living kindness, starts with the very first step in the process, sending love to yourself. Many people find this to be an intimidating order. It's not easy to have thoughts of loving kindness towards yourself. For some people, it's very difficult. They don't, we get caught in the I don't deserve to be happy and healthy and to live at ease. Somehow or other, it's not appropriate, right? Many people find this to be an intimidating order, but I think that difficulty results from another misunderstanding of metta. You don't earn metta by being extra good or nice. Interesting statement. You don't earn metta by being extra good or nice. You don't get metta points for being generous or selfless. Metta isn't really a part of the karmic economy. It's more of a birthright. Everyone deserves this, without exception. Here are two reasons to give metta to yourself. It's hard to give love to others if you don't give it to yourself, and your heart longs for love. When it comes to loving others, it makes sense that if our feelings towards ourselves are unkind, any effort to be kind to others will be adulterated. These efforts will always be colored by some form of neediness. Either we will be trying to get validation from others, or trying to compensate for our lack of self-worth by being extra good. These external efforts will never succeed as long as our inner world feels barren. And it's that very barren feeling that makes us think we don't deserve love. We look inside and see anxiety and sadness, worry and stress, irritation and judgment. Then we equate feeling bad with being bad. It's a really important statement. Then we equate feeling bad with being bad. In this formulation, if we are bad, then we clearly don't deserve love. Instead of self-judgment, metta encourages us to care for us ourselves simply because we are suffering, to be kind to the sadness and worry, to be gentle with the judgment and irritation. We actually give love to those very feelings. Rather than fighting our inner life, we open to it with acceptance and compassion. It's a different way of looking at how we live our lives and how we see ourselves. We're all, without exception, deserving of loving kindness, of experiencing it in our lives, without exception. But the sutta goes on. This is my notes is just what follows is another classic Buddhist list, making sure we understand that everyone is included. and we must practice metta for all beings. So he says, whatever living beings there may be, pretty quick, whatever living beings there may be, it's like, don't forget anybody. Don't live anyone out. Don't just, everyone's included. And living beings means not just humans. It's perfectly fine to have thoughts of loving kindness towards your dog or your cat, or that cow out in the field, or the squirrel you met while you're doing your walk in the street, or whatever. That worm, that snake, all beings, whatever living beings, no exceptions to living. So we can't say, well, that's okay, but I don't know about pigeons and rats. We can't leave anything out, okay? Whether they are weak or strong, omitting none. Once again, emphasizing, you can't leave anyone out. You can't just have loving thoughts of loving kindness for the weak or just for the strong. Two pieces of how we look at the world. We have to have loving kindness for everyone. And then it goes on, the seen and the unseen. So this is like, it's so easy for us to have thoughts of loving kindness for the seen. People we see every day, people we see regularly, people we're close to. It's sort of natural to have thoughts of loving kindness. I mean, you want everyone you care about to have, be safe, happy, healthy, and at ease, right? But what about the billions of beings that we don't see every day? I mean, the vast majority of people maybe are have contact and connection in some heart level, maybe 100. That would be a pretty busy life, actually. But what about all those other billions of beings out there? So the seen and the unseen just emphasizes everyone. All those people you don't see that are unseen to us, right? Those living near and far away, the same idea yet again. Don't forget that, people who live far away are just as much deserving metta as people who live close to us. And then he says, those born and to be born. So those born are people who are alive today, but those to be born, it's like people who aren't even alive yet. And here I've seen little funny things happen here. Often we think of those to be born sort of means the unborn, which in our current cultural foo-foo-rah, means fetuses essentially. People, individuals that haven't taken, aren't fully formed yet. This is not, I want to make this very clear, this is not what the Buddha is talking about here. This does not, just don't go there. Instead, I think we want to think of this as meaning future generations. Those born and to be, those beings to be born are people who are going to come after us. And if we're having thoughts of loving kindness, we want to have thoughts of loving kindness for those people. Oh, if I have thoughts of loving kindness to people who aren't even born yet, what does that mean? And it means, well, I have to sort of take care of the world. So they, when they are born, they come into a world that's going to be able to give them what they need, that they can live at ease, that they're not going to live in a world that's falling apart, like the world is today, unfortunately. And so this is where I think the ideas of what's called eco-dharma, the ideas around how we have to preserve the world as an act of loving kindness, how we have to consciously think about taking care of the world as a purely as an act of loving kindness for those who haven't even come yet, because they're going to be and they're going to exist in this world, and we need to take care of it. And it's interesting to me that the Buddha would think of it that this was important. But even in his day, I'm sure forests were being despoiled and chopped down, and parts of North India were already being denuded of trees and that sort of thing. So maybe he was a closet Ecodharma person, or anything else. Then the Buddha, so that's that list, the born to, may all beings be at ease. It repeats that one more time. So this is like three times already he said this. And then he sort of says, oh, but by the way, just to make sure you understand what I'm talking about, he then says, let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. This is, he's literally describing the opposite of loving kindness. This is called the, in tradition is called the far enemy of loving kindness. The opposite of loving kindness is ill will. Loving kindness, you see, sometimes translated, the word metta translated as goodwill and ill will. Right? So ill will, which is what he's saying here, is like, don't go there. Don't even think about it. And it's very easy for us in our somewhat calm lives, hopefully, to think, oh, well, I would never do that. I'm not like that. Think about the time when you heard that some not very nice person had been caught and punished. And the thought arose in your mind, he deserves it. He got what he deserved. It's good that he's suffering now. That's ill will. Something we go to all the time in our minds without even thinking about it. That's just where the mind goes. And it's like, instead, when we encounter those sorts of beings in our lives in one way or another, we have to have thoughts of goodwill towards them. We have to offer them metta. I've been struggling for 8 years to offer thoughts of metta towards Donald Trump. It's really hard, let me tell you. It's a big struggle in my life. But if I don't do that, then I rant. And I have thoughts of ill will towards him. And that's unwholesome, based on what the Buddha's teaching. That's not where we want to go. We have to both work as hard as we possibly can to make sure he never gets reelected or has any power anywhere in the world ever again, and have thoughts of loving kindness towards him. It's a tricky balance. But that's where we have to find that balance. And that's just, I'm just using that as an obvious example, but we all can think of people that we probably have thoughts of ill will towards from time to time, whether they're politicians or that crazy relative or that ex-partner who, or whatever. That's where ill will arises in our lives. Okay. Then he goes on, and the next section, he's talking about how strong should the feeling of metta be? How deep, how powerful is this? And this very poetic section, actually. He says, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child. Think of how strong that would be. And I know I have to be careful. I know some people have difficult relationships with their mother. Then replace mother with favorite aunt or whoever. It doesn't make any difference. Someone else who you don't have difficulty with. But think about, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. A boundless heart. no limits, right? Later on in the same section, he says, there's the phrase, yeah, out, we're practicing, we should, loving kindness should be outwards and unbounded. Ill will binds our heart, constricts it. It stops it from expressing wholesome feelings. So we want to have our heart and mind be unbounded. And there's other images here, spreading upwards to the sky and downwards to the depths, in all directions, in other words. In other places, in other bits of sutta where he talks about metta, he talks about offering metta in the six directions, east, west, north, south, up, down. There's even some places where they say the 10 directions, so sort of in between the up and down, the left and right is somewhere in the middle between. You can take this to an extreme, right? But it's like you see these teachings where he's saying, spread it around to everyone. It goes everywhere without exception. And then he says, oh yeah, but here's, and he reminds us, free from hatred and ill will. Free from hatred and ill will. Once again, he's just keeps repeating to remind us, right? And then there's really interesting, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. Well, this is Buddhist code. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, really means all the time. When are you not standing, walking, seated, or lying down? I mean, this is exactly the same phrase appears in the Satipatthana Sutta when the Buddha is giving instructions on mindfulness. Exactly the same phrase. It basically means all the time. But then he makes it one free from drowsiness. So we can't sort of half do this. We have to do this skillfully and be wide awake. Don't do it energetically. And one should sustain this recollection. We should keep remembering. Remember, sati, which we can translate as mindfulness. Another translation of sati is remembering. So if you're practicing metta, you have to keep remembering to practice metta. You have to remember every time you encounter another being to offer them metta. It's a big ask again. It's like all the time without exception. But then he says, this is said to be the sublime abiding. So if we could actually always be practicing metta in all directions for all beings all the time, this would be a sublime abiding. Abiding meaning where we live. We live in this emotional place of love for all beings all the time. Joseph Goldstein had this teacher called Dipama, and he once asked her, what's going on in your mind all the time? And she said, basically said, either metta or mindfulness. That's all that was ever in her mind. She must have been a remarkable woman. There's actually quite a beautiful book about her if you want to read about her life and stuff. Anyhow, little digression there, but that would, I can't imagine what that would be like. I'm like, I have tastes of it. That just be full of loving kindness and mindfulness all the time. That would be pretty sublime. Right? Sublime is like, the best. Then he goes on and he says, and this the last four lines are basically describing what it means if that's true. How that could be. He says, by not holding to fixed views. Much of the ill will we feel towards others is because we get caught up in views that some people are good and other people are bad. Buddhists are good. Islamic fundamentalists are bad. That's where our mind goes. It's so easy to go there. And both these views give rise to ill will. Both of these views. Buddhists are good mean, if Buddhists are good, well, that's ex sort of narrowing down the view of who's good to just the Buddhist people. And those Islamic revolutionaries, oh, they're definitely bad, every one of them, without exception. We know that. And so he's pointing very clearly to the idea, just as he does in the teachings on the Four Noble Truths, that the big problem we have is in the Second Noble Truth, we cling to views. We cling to ideas of who's good, who's bad, who deserves loving kindness, who doesn't, who's worthy, who isn't worthy. And when we're in this place of sublime abiding, by not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, seeing things as they really are, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires. Ah, so here's just making sure we understand that we can't cling to anything. Sense desires, things of the senses are what we often end up clinging to. So we don't want to cling to sense objects. We don't want to cling to views and opinions. So being freed from all sense desires is not born again into this world. That last line is basically saying this is a practice of liberation, that this practice leads towards enlightenment. Without a doubt, this is an enlightenment practice. Because to be not born into this world again basically means that there's no need to have come back, no need for the energy contained in this particular incarnation, this particular body mind doesn't need to go on anymore. It's done its job, it's become enlightened, it's going to disappear. The tricky part is often this idea of not being born again can turn into really unwholesome thoughts, and that it's like somehow or other we're trying to get out of this body. That there's something wrong with having a body. That if having a physical body is a burden, well, actually, without a physical body, you can't practice. Oops. So it's like, and this turns into, this idea of denigrating the body or mortifying the body or thinking that the body, it's the body's fault that it keeps leading me astray. Body's just the body. It has physical energy and it has all those things associated with it. There's nothing wrong with the body at all. And nothing wrong with having a body. In fact, you need a body until you're an enlightened being, then okay, now I'm done with this having a body stuff. The karmic energy around this disappears. It's just not, doesn't need to take another body. It's done its job. This bundle of karmic energy has become connected to a being that became enlightened. It's gone. That's all that means. Nothing to do with bodies being bad or inappropriate or something we have to fight against. It's something that we see a lot in misinterpreted spiritual practices and teachings in the world, where people go to that place. So that's the Metta Sutta. This is the teachings of the Buddha on loving kindness. And it's, I think the key things here is just something that has this, right, the very first line, this is what must be done. This is a practice This isn't just like this beautiful poetic teaching, which it is, but at the same time, it's we actually have to do something. We actually have to consciously, all the time, whether standing, walking, seated, or lying down, as much as we can, as often as we can, remember this teaching and put it into practice in the world. This is a poem by Hafiz, one of my favorite Sufi poet that sort of sums this up, I think. It's called "If God Invited You to a Party." Right. Hafiz has a sense of humor. If God invited you to a party and said, "Everyone in the ballroom tonight will be my special guest," how would you then treat them when you arrived? Indeed, indeed. And Hafiz knows there is no one in this world who is not upon his jeweled dance floor. Can't leave anybody out because all beings are on the jeweled dance floor. I love that, the image.